everyone. Calling the State Affairs Committee to order at 3:03 p.m. Will the Secretary please take the roll?
Representative Wolf?
Present.
Representative Josephson? Representative Ledoux? Representative Birch?
Here.
Representative Johnson?
Present.
Representative Tuck?
Here.
Representative Knopf?
Here.
Chair Price Tompkins?
Here. And with six members present, we have quorum. Thank you all for being here, and also thank you, Martha, the recording secretary, and Greg in the back of the room, the LIO operator, for your help. Reminders to silence cell phones if you have them. I'm not sure if we have a donut rule, maybe a carrot rule or something. And today is also our first week in which we have finance subcommittee meetings, and so this standing policy committee will adjourn a few minutes before 4:30 p.m. and will reconvene with finance subcommittee chair Representative Guttenberg from the university at 4:30 p.m. We'll be doing the same routine on Thursday with the university subcommittee, the Department of Administration subcommittee, with Representative Gren chairing. We have three items on the agenda today. HB 71, which is the state employee pay increase, freezing it for the next 2 years. House Bill 7, the ballot selfie bill, and House Bill 31, relating to sexual assault examination kits. And we'll be hearing them in that order. For the first two pieces of legislation, we'll hear the pieces of legislation but hold them, as well as not take public testimony today. However, with House Bill 31, the sexual assault examination kit legislation, we will make as much progress as we can in the available time. So with that, I would like to invite the sponsor, Department of Administration and Governor's Office, to come up to the table to testify on House Bill 71.
Great. Thank you for having us. My name is Sheldon Fisher. I'm the Commissioner of the Department of Administration. I'm here with Leslie Riedel, who is our Deputy Commissioner. And as was noted, we're here to talk about HB 71, which is the governor's bill to freeze salaries for non-union employees. And moving to slide one, I think most people know that the governor in his budget announced that he was proposing a pay freeze for non-covered employees. It should be noted that he has also asked us to, in our negotiations, to negotiate similar language with each of our bargaining units as we move forward. I think that the rationale that the governor has is recognizing the fiscal challenges we face, recognizing that we're asking our citizens to reduce the permanent fund distribution that they receive. I think he felt like it was appropriate to for a period of time, freeze the salary increases, the automatic salary increases that come to our employees. And so the bill does that. It freezes COLAs for this group. And that's the reference to general pay increases. It should be noted that we have not given a COLA. This administration has not given a COLA and has not negotiated a COLA since we came into office. It also freezes merit increase, pay increments, and any other bonuses, et cetera. This bill also allows the governor to reduce his salary. The governor announced that he would like to cut his salary by a third, but the way that absent this bill, the way that would work is he would have to receive his full salary, pay taxes on that full salary, and then return whatever amount he chose, in essence, as a gift back to the state treasury. And so this bill would allow him to just reduce his salary so he didn't have to pay taxes on the amount that that he would return.
And sorry to interject, Commissioner Representative Ledoux, for the record, has joined us at 3:08. Please continue.
Sure.
Representative Wohl.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Through the chair, just some clarity there. I didn't quite understand what you just said. He gets his full salary, pays taxes on the full, and then gifts out a third? And is that different than what anyone else could do?
Through the chair, so what the governor would like to do is to reduce his salary. And if he reduces his salary, then he would only pay taxes on the new reduced amount. Absent this bill, what he would be forced to do is to receive a pay of taxes on the full amount and then return some portion.
Okay. I missed the word absent. Thank you.
And Representative Johnson, also a question.
Well, I guess on that same note, is there a real difference in that? I mean, the net is the same.
Through the chair, the net could be orchestrated to be the same, but the governor would like to reduce his salary by a third, and if he wanted his take-home pay to be the same, then he would have to be something less than a third, and I think he feels like he shouldn't be paying the federal government taxes on some amount of money that he is not receiving, and so this bill would just allow him to do that.
Representative Tuck, exciting subject.
What is the governor's salary currently?
The governor's salary is $150,000 a year, I believe.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Birch, please.
Does this affect future governors, or is this a standalone? Through the chair, I just.
This bill, by its terms, would last 2 years and then would sunset, and so that would not extend beyond this governor's.
Thank you. And Commissioner, please proceed. And just as a matter of process, just given the brevity of the five-slide length of this presentation, perhaps you can present and then we can let loose with our curiosity.
Thank you. Moving to slide two then. This just references who is included in the bill, and so it includes non-covered employees or employees that are not covered in the collective bargaining agreement that are part of the executive branch, including boards, commissions, and authorities and that group of employees. It also includes employees in the legislative branch. It includes employees that are not covered under collective bargaining in the university, and then the governor and the lieutenant governor and department heads and legislators. I should note it does not include the court system, happy to go into detail. That is primarily a separation of powers concern that we did not include the courts. Moving to slide three. The bill is required because merit pay and pay increments are included in statute, and so we do not have the flexibility to implement this absent legislation. And as I mentioned early on, this is part of the governor's budget package and intended to address the shortfalls, in part, the shortfalls that the state is facing. And then slide four is my last substantive slide. The bill will affect approximately 5,000 state employees. This is approximately 23% of the workforce in the executive and legislative branches. And over the two-year period, the savings would be about $4.2 million. And that concludes the presentation.
All right. Thank you, Commissioner. In the queue, Representative Ledoux and Representative Knopp, you thereafter.
So I was just curious when you were saying that it did not include the courts because that's a separation of powers issue, but it includes the legislature. So if there's a separation of powers issue, why would it include the legislature? I mean, if you can include the legislature, I don't see why you can't include the courts.
Thank you. That's a great question, through the chair. The reasoning, as has been explained to me, is this is a law, ultimately if it is adopted, it's a law that is adopted in statute by the legislature, and so the legislature is participating in the enactment of that statute. And it is a law that is signed into effect by the executive branch, and so the executive branch, in essence, has acceded to or accepted the legislation. The court system is outside that legislative process, and so the legal view is that it would be an impermissible intrusion on their operations to include them in the legislation.
Just follow up.
Yeah, Representative Ledoux.
You mean the legislature has no say in employee compensation in the courts?
The legislature obviously is the appropriating body, and therefore you have the discretion to appropriate their budget. And I guess I would defer to others to say that you have no say, but I think there are limitations in how far under a separation of power the legislature or the governor can collectively work together in terms of managing or dictating the salaries in the court system.
Thank you. And just one more follow-up. If you chose not to freeze the merit increases, would there be anything that would keep you from simply changing the range of people? I mean, so if you like, for example, what the legislature did this past session, it said that virtually all legislative staffers would be capped at a high of 22. I mean, there are some exceptions to that. But it used to be, as a matter of course, that a lot of legislative chiefs of staff were at a 23, and there were a lot of long-term employees that were at a 24, and we just said that it's going to go to a 22. Is there anything that would keep you from doing it that way?
Through the chair, I'll have to call a lifeline. I'm not sure.
Through the chair, it's Assistant Attorney General Bill Milks, and I work with the Department of Legislation on a variety of matters. Through the chair, representative, question. I mean, by statute, the state has a salary schedule. And that's a law that's been enacted by the legislature. And it has various ranges in it. But then for the executive branch and administering that, there is something called the constitutional merit principle, in which you have to look at different positions and assign them to ranges accordingly. So I guess that's my quick answer. It's a rather complex question, but
I actually don't understand the answer at all. I mean, if you wanted to, if somebody was a range 22 and you wanted to save money, could you make them a range 21 or a 20?
Well, through the chair, again, the ranges and how much money is paid for each range is through the salary schedule that's adopted by the legislature. It's in statute. But then when the executive has to decide where within the ranges different jobs fit based on their skill requirements, their job duties and things, you then go into a rather complex classification analysis, which the division of personnel tackles and deals with those kinds of issues. But I'm not sure just saying we want to save money and we'll change a range. I'm not really sure if that's something that the executive could do.
Follow up, Representative Ledoux.
Again, through the chair, the statute does establish the the salaries for ranges.
Just one follow-up. So nobody who's ever been, let's say, at a range 23 has ever gone to a range 22 or a range 21?
If I can try, through the chair, I think, I'm sure that that has happened. I think what Mr. Milks is saying is that in cases where it has happened, it's consistent with the merit principle, meaning that perhaps their job function changed or there were other principles consistent with the merit principles in the Constitution that allowed that change. The question that I think we would need to do more analysis around to give you a definitive answer is, could there be a wholesale direction to reduce salaries or to cap, and would that be consistent with the merit principle established in the Constitution? And that would be the analysis that we'd have to think more seriously about.
And Commissioner Fisher, can you identify yourself for the record?
Thank you.
Sorry,
Commissioner Fisher from the Department of Administration.
Sorry,
thank you. Please, thank you for reminding me.
Thank you.
Representative Knopp.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner, thanks. So I'll just tell you right off before I ask the question, I got a serious level of discomfort with the bill. The structure is good, but there's some serious inequalities in that makeup. As the other representative just mentioned, we have moved existing staff from 23, 24 levels down to 22. And some of the inequalities I talk about is we've done that in the House, but the other body in this legislative session has not done that. You have some departments that are negotiated wages and don't have step and quarterly increases, period. In that sense, the question I have, if the Chair allows me some, you mentioned 5,000 employees affected by this. Is this all across the university system and in every department as well? Is that number figured in there?
Through the chair, yes. That $5,000, 5,000 employees crosses the executive branch, the legislature, these other corporations, and the university, not including the court system, of course, because they're not part of it.
And so, if I not through the chair, if I may, so some of the inequalities I talk about is that we talk about the represented employees bargaining units, and so we have teachers who still receive COLAs, cost of living merits, but now the university teachers aren't eligible; they're froze. So that's that, and I really go to our bargaining units. I mean, if this is not a bad concept, but the problem is it's not shared equally, is my problem. And so when you mention that the administration has talked about negotiating freezes in the bargaining units as these contracts come up, but there's no guarantees in that. And so this may be a question for your Assistant Attorney General, but can this House, can this body write that into the language that there will be no negotiated merit or step increases in them contracts for 2 years? I mean, could we bind the administration in them contract negotiations if we wanted to share this thing equally?
So let me answer a couple of thoughts, and then first of all, when you think about the principles of equality, there is no question that we have a different bargaining schedule, and we bargain about a third of our collective bargaining agreements each year. And so whenever we make a change, that it takes a number of years for that to kind of be adopted across the spectrum of bargaining units. And it's important to start somewhere, and I think we feel like it's not unreasonable to start with our uncovered employees, as the governor has proposed. In terms of whether you can dictate in statute that prohibits us from negotiating this, I think you have that right. And so let me turn and just make sure, but I think you have the right. And, of course, we bring all of the collective bargaining agreements to you for your approval. And you can reject any contract that's inconsistent. But
thank you, Commissioner. Thank you.
Appreciate it.
Representative Wall?
Yeah, I just have a few questions for the presenters here. Let's see. Why is 2019 savings less than 2018?
So the way these work is the pay increments happen every year, but the merit increases are every other year. And so it's just a just kind of the way the math happens to work, that there are more that are receiving those in one year than another.
And Representative Wu, I'm sorry, follow up, please.
Please, go ahead.
I'll have one more after this at this point, but I'll ask each time. Follow up through the chair. What Representative Wu was talking about was a range reduction previously. This is nothing like that. This is a straight-up freeze, right?
Through the chair, yes. This would be a freeze for their salaries.
And who? Follow up, please. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Who? What other has other sort of groups of employees under the state system taken a freeze at this point? In the last couple of years since this fiscal crisis?
Yeah, through the chair, no. This is the first salary freeze that we've put forward.
Wonderful. Is this the only sort of non-collectively bargained group of employees, and are the other ones collectively bargained, so it would be harder to implement a freeze, such as teachers or university professors or someone along those lines?
Through the chair, yes. The majority of our employees are subject to a collective bargaining, and so as I mentioned, we have been instructed by the governor that in the collective bargaining agreements that we negotiate that we would implement a comparable freeze, but those would occur as those bargaining agreements arise over time.
Okay. Thank you.
Representative Birch?
Through the chair, I think my question was largely addressed. It related to the 5,000 employees being roughly 23% of the total employment population, and that works out to around 21,700 employees. And it appears that the savings, if you extrapolated at that same ratio, would be approaching $20 million. So I guess my question would be, I would certainly encourage negotiating that with the labor contracts. And I think there's 11, again through the chair, I think there's 11 labor contracts you had indicated earlier. Are they all pretty much already final out and negotiated, or do they come up again soon?
So through the chair, we're in negotiations right now with the troopers, as well as three of the Marine highways bargaining units, and then a couple of teachers unions, the teachers at Apteca there in Seward, as well as this Mount Edgecombe School. And so those are being negotiated now, and then there will be another set that will be negotiated next year. And yeah.
Cool. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you. And Representative Technics in queue, and I think maybe thereafter we can move on to the next piece of legislation for a hearing in order to get to, we include Representative Johnson as well, just to have a well-rounded series of questions, and then perhaps move the second agenda on today's calendar for state affairs. Representative Tuck.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The courts, going back to the court system, so how are their wages and benefits determined now?
Through the chair, they adopt their own rules and policies around wages and benefits.
And that's through regulations? Mr.
Follow-up, yeah.
Through the chair, I guess I've got to confess, I don't know whether they've just got a policy handbook or whether they formally adopt regulations. Just a moment. Forgive me, we'll have to get back to you, whether it's through a handbook or a formal regulatory process.
And Commissioner Fisher, I see Nancy Mead in the back of the room in case that's a relevant fact.
And then if I may, Mr. Chair.
Yes, please.
So the Constitution, which you're referring to, is Article 12 on the merit system, Section 6. And it simply states, the legislature shall establish a system under which the merit principle will govern the employment of persons by the state. So I guess the question I have is the definition of merit. I would think that if employees are not underneath a collective bargaining agreement, that merit can mean it can go up or it can go down. So how is it that you wouldn't be able to do that already based on the Constitution?
Through the chair, forgive me. As I understood the question was, could we freeze people at a particular level? And let's just use an example. Let's assume we've got a highly skilled attorney or doctor, let's say, and they're a range 29, just. And now, let's say we want to freeze them at a range 20 that is comparable to someone that has much less education and skill and contributes, less education and skill. The question I think that is implied by that clause that you just read is, are we being consistent with the merit principle if we treat those two people at a range 20 and don't acknowledge the additional education, skill, and capabilities of that doctor in this example? And I don't know that we are saying we couldn't. I think that what Mr. Milks, the point he was making is that is a more sophisticated analysis that we would need to perform to be able to assure you that we can. But we think that there are concerns about that principle implied by the question.
And if I may, Mr. Chair, so I guess it's going to be case law definition on merit principle then that we'd have to look to. And then I see that, as Representative Ledoux had pointed out, we do have a separation between the legislative branch and the executive branch. However, we do oversee the budgets for all three branches. So why under this merit system general provision would court system employees be excluded when our Constitution says we'll govern the employment of persons by the state? I don't understand where. I understand separation of powers, but in the purposes of being an appropriating body and it says here, we'll govern the employment of the persons of the state, how the judicial system is excluded, or is there somewhere else in the Constitution that addresses that?
Through the chair, I don't know that there's another section in the Constitution. If you'd like, we can invite Mr. Milks up. What I understand is that the basic principle, again, if we use an example, imagine a scenario where the legislature did not like the salary, or did not like the opinions that were being issued by the Supreme Court, and concluded that we would pay justices on the Supreme Court a salary of a dollar a year. Even though you've given plenty of money for the court system, and so I think the view is that the court, as a matter of separation of powers principles, the court system needs to have the flexibility to manage their own affairs so that they remain independent from the legislature or the executive branch. I should also just note that the court system, I think, has been quite aggressive in furloughs and other cuts, has been, I think, fairly careful about trying to reduce cuts, and they've shut the court systems down at on a certain schedule and really worked hard to try to reduce salaries as well. So I don't want to leave any impression that the court system is not aggressively managing cost.
And if I may, Mr. Chair,
final follow up.
This does open up a lot more questions. I know that we've seen it before that the legislature, not liking a governor's appointment, will try to zero out that person's PCN number specifically. So I know that happens, and I agree. I don't know how you make that separation between the executive and the legislative, and still able to make that separation between the judicial and legislative. But I will reserve my further questions until another time.
Yeah. We can schedule a special constitutional law seminar to see this. Representative Johnson, and then I believe there's a singular final question from Representative Ledoux, and we can move on to the next piece of legislation.
In looking through this, thank you, Mr. Chair. Through the chair, I'm looking at this, I was just kind of curious. It's brought forward by the governor. What portions of this bill or these the pay does the governor already control? I mean, maybe he wants to not have to pay gift tax. He can still do that. He can still give up a portion of his pay. Where nothing in here is enabling him to do something he couldn't do already. My question is, I mean, if he has commissioners he wants to freeze, can it, or reduce your pay, he could do that certainly, I would think, already. What portions of this pay does the governor not already control?
Through the chair, are you referring specifically to the governor's pay or to everybody?
Well, whoever's in here that the governor could control the pay already. I mean, can the governor change the commissioner's pay or freeze your pay? Or because that's inside the executive branch. That was thanks, Mr. Chair.
Through the chair, I mean, the governor cannot implement this salary freeze without this legislation. We wouldn't be here if we could. He would have implemented that. And so, if I understand the question correctly, we could not accomplish the savings and the impact that are described in this bill without this legislation. Follow up?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. But if the merit pay could go up or down, he could potentially have the same effect within the operation of his internally, or is that not correct?
I don't believe it is. I don't understand the question. In other words, the merit pay cannot go up or down. The merit pay is defined
levels.
It's a defined amount, and provided that the employee is performing and it gets an acceptable review, then they get they receive this automatic. They receive this step increase, and there's not really a discretion around that as it's currently structured.
Representative Ledoux, final question?
Yeah, just following up on the judge's question of Representative Tuck and your example when you talked about the difference between the judiciary and the legislative branch, and I think you gave the example, if you didn't like the judge's opinion, what would happen if you just decided to give him a dollar a year? I just wanted to confirm with somebody that I think the salaries of judges as opposed to general court personnel are actually constitutionally guaranteed for the time of their service. And maybe I'm wrong there, but that's what I thought. Maybe there's somebody from the court system that would...
Commissioner, if you wouldn't mind, we could have multiple answers.
Thank you. Through the chair, let me just say this. And we can come back and talk more about this separation of power. The basic principle is that there's a principle that this statute would be adopted by the legislature and signed by the executive branch, and therefore extending the coverage of this to those two branches of government seems appropriate and doesn't offend the separation of powers principles in the Constitution. Extending it beyond to the court system is viewed as troublesome because they are not part of the legislative process and don't have a way, in essence, to protect themselves from mischief.
Overreaching.
Fair.
Thank you very much, Commissioner Fisher and Deputy Commissioner. Next up for today's schedule is House Bill 7. And if the presenters would be able to come up to the table, introduce the bill, and field questions, and I'm hoping we can transition to House Bill 31, right around 4 o'clock or maybe a few minutes before. Yourself and senior affiliation for the record and introducing the legislation.
Of course. I'm Alicia Norden. I'm a UA intern for Representative Jonathan Christ Tompkins, and I'm here to present HB 7 ballot selfies. So ballot selfies are currently illegal in the state of Alaska, and a ballot selfie is when a person takes a picture of themselves with the ballot within the ballot box. And the goal of HB 7 is just to make them legal. Ballot selfies are an expression of support for a candidate or a cause or even just to vote. And the law isn't very heavily enforced currently here in Alaska, so it's not like we'd be dramatically changing law. Bans on ballot selfies have already been ruled unconstitutional in several other states, so we'd just be following the trend across the United States. And we have had raised concerns from the divisions of elections concerning the prohibition of electioneering, and we're currently working on them with Ledge Legal to create language to address these problems, and we're in the process of making an amendment to add to this bill. We're not presenting it today, though.
Thank you, Ms. Norton. Any questions from the committee? Representative Birch.
Through the chair, who would you anticipate would object to this? As someone that has actually taken a ballot selfie, if you will, have you identified any concerted opposition to this for one reason or another?
Through the chair, we have had one person stop by the office, and they expressed concerns with ballot buying or vote buying, and they also expressed concerns, which I'm planning on looking into, with APOC and whether or not this could be counted as advertising. But as I said, I'm planning on looking into it.
Great. Thank you. Representative Wall.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So currently it's against the law to take a picture of yourself with a ballot or just the ballot? And when you say ballot selfie, that's a picture of a person with the ballot, is that correct?
Through the chair, a ballot selfie is a photo of yourself with your ballot.
Follow up. Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, and that's stated in statute somewhere that is illegal?
Through the chair, it's not stated that you can't take a ballot selfie. It's stated that you're not allowed to present your ballot. So you wouldn't, I don't have the exact language, but it's in statute that you're not allowed to show your ballot to another person.
Follow up? So if I go in the voting booth and take it, or mail-in ballot form or whatever it is, and I take a picture of just that without me, that has some check boxes. Of course, my ballot doesn't have my name on it. And then I present that photo, that reproduction, and I show it to someone as a ballot with some who I voted for, but without my face in it. Is that also against the law currently?
Through the chair, yes. It's currently against the law, but hopefully with this change, that would be legal.
Has anyone been prosecuted for that crime in this state?
Through the chair, I'm not 100% for sure, but I haven't read or seen anything of anyone being prosecuted.
Representative Liu.
Do you know whether anybody has ever been prosecuted in any other state?
Through the chair, I do. I don't have the exact, actually, I think I do. One second. In Colorado, there was a woman who was prosecuted, and she filed suit saying that it was a violation of her right to freedom of speech. And then in... Yes, I'll finish with that.
Representative
Liddell. Follow up, when she filed suit, what happened?
Through the chair, it was ruled in her favor that it was a, I guess, infringement of her freedom of speech.
Thank you.
Representative Tuck.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So right now it's a it's electioneering prohibition. And so when we talk about electioneering, I'm guessing that it is affecting, because I think there's limitations of where you can, how close you can campaign, and whether or not you can wear any campaign buttons or campaign materials bring with you when you approach a polling location. And so it sounds like that originally the reason why they have this act to where a voter may not exhibit the voter's ballot in an election to an election official or to any other person is because you're probably within that 200-foot zone of the polling location. And so am I getting that correct? That, 'cause I'm trying to figure out what was the original intent of this, of people not being able to exhibit their ballots. I think it's probably limited to that. So that's my question. Am I on the right track?
Through the chair, could you restate your question?
Yeah, so is the reason why we had the prohibition in the first place is because if you were to show your ballot and how you marked your ballot, you're in a polling location. And I think the reason why that's considered prohibition, electioneering prohibition, is because you are influencing those people around you by how you voted, where there is not to be any electioneering within 200 feet of a polling location. So am I correct in stating that that may be the original reason why you could not show your ballot to somebody else, because it was a form of electioneering, as if you were walking in with a campaign button?
Through the chair, yes.
Representative Hill.
Excuse me, along that same line of question. Thank you, Mr. Chair. So you mentioned vote buying, which I imagine is, again, I'm all imagining, but someone would go to a ballot booth, fill out their ballot, and then prove to the person who's buying their vote that they've actually voted as they were commissioned to. So if they took a photo of the ballot and then showed the photo, I guess that accomplishes the same thing. I mean, maybe that's why the original statute, so you didn't have a way to prove to someone how you voted. And maybe, and I don't know, I guess currently the law would be that if you go to a ballot booth and have a picture and have the ballot on your phone, and then you walk around with your phone in the polling area. That would also be a electioneering violation. I don't, stuff I've never really thought about, but so again, walking around with your phone in a polling place, would that still be a violation, or is that an expression of free speech or self-expression?
Through the chair, I'm really happy you asked that, because that was a concern that's already been brought to me. With the amendment that we're working on with the Division of Elections, we're working to create language that will prevent people from taking a photo of their ballot and then presenting that within the polling place or within 200 feet of the polling place. And yes.
Thank you.
I can add to that briefly, Representative Wolf, through the chair. This is Reed Magdans, also staff to Rep. Christ Tompkins. Alicia's right there that it was brought to our attention by the division that the language as drafted might leave the possibility open that you could share that photo within the polling place. We're working on an amendment to clarify that that is not our intention and that you should not be able to take your phone and then show the marked ballot within the polling place of the 200 feet.
Thank you. Representative Ledoux, then Representative Tuck.
How would you prevent somebody leaving the polling place and they're outside of that 200 feet limit, but somebody in the polling place happens to have a cell phone and they're in the polling place and they're seeing the ballot?
Representative Ledoux, through the chair, certainly that seems like something that's possible in the modern day with people bringing their phones into the polling place. You could go home, put your ballot on your Facebook page saying, "Everyone go vote, I did." And one of your friends could walk into the polling place and be scrolling through their phone while they're standing in line, and they could see that. And as currently drafted, we feel that is kind of in line with protecting free speech and okay as far as we're concerned. Though, of course, if the committee has concerns about that, then we should work on the bill.
Representative Tuck?
This is the exact same question I was going to ask.
It's like we've entered the Matrix. Representative Knopp.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, do you know, if I go over here to the little booth and fill out my ballot and then I walk out, and I'm going to walk across the room and put it in the corner of the box, and I just take it out and display it as I'm walking across the room, is that illegal to do that? Can I display my ballot?
Yeah, Representative Knopp, through the chair, that is illegal right now and will remain illegal under this bill.
Okay, thank you.
Further questions from the committee? Thank you, Mr. Magdans and Ms. Norton, for the presentation. And that brings us to the third and final piece of legislation on today's schedule, sponsored by Representative Tarr, who I don't see in the room, House Bill 31, or she may be out in the hallway. She is out in the hallway, just like that. Stage entrance.
It's in our secret changing area.
House Bill 31 relating to sexual assault examination kits. Welcome, Representative Tarr, and can you identify yourself and put yourself on the record and introduce your legislation?
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. Nice to say that for the first time this session. I'm Representative Garen Tarr from Anchorage, and I just want to thank the committee for taking the time early in the session to consider this bill that I think is of great importance. Just a few weeks ago, serial rapist Clifford Lee was sentenced to 90 years for 4 rapes and 1 attempted rape in 2014. Mr. Lee had a long history of systematically targeting and raping disadvantaged women. DNA testing provided by a rape kit tied Mr. Lee to additional unsolved rapes in 2001 and 2005. So for 16 years, this dangerous criminal has been in our community and possibly had been in our community possibly harming other victims. In your bill packet, there's an article about this particular individual. This is just the most recent story that brutally reminds us of Alaska's epidemic of sexual assault. It reminds us of our responsibility to victims to diligently collect and process evidence to bring violators to justice and remove perpetrators from our communities. Alaska currently has a backlog of 3,600 untested rape kits. This is an enormous disrespect to the victims who have endured the trauma of sexual assault and then take the effort to be tested, only to have this evidence be disregarded. We respect the right of any victim that may choose to not press charges to avoid additional trauma, and our intent is that a victim would have that right and that the DNA could be entered into the database to use for solving other crimes. As well, our communities remain at risk to rapists who escape justice who may have been verified by the DNA evidence. Alaska consistently ranks among the highest in the nation for rates of rape and sexual assault. We must do everything we can to turn around this epidemic. In 2015, I was proud to sponsor House Bill 117 regarding Alaska's backlog of sexual assault examination kits. I applaud Governor Walker and his staff who then took on this issue and successfully procured a $1.1 million federal Department of Justice grant to inventory and process the backlog kits. Moving forward, HB 31 establishes a new system to avoid a backlog from ever developing like we have today. It establishes a uniform protocol for processing rape kits. This will assist Alaska's more than 200 law enforcement agencies to consistently collect and process the sensitive evidence in a timely manner. It requires the rape kits are sent for testing no later than 18 months after the sexual assault examination. As well, HB 31 requires the Department of Public Safety to report on the number of untested rape kits. And that way we can rest assured that this is not happening. We're not building up a backlog. This approach is part of a national effort in many states, and while Alaska is newer to this effort, what's been shown in states across the country is that getting this DNA evidence catches dangerous criminals and makes our community safer. So in an effort to give the victims who deserve justice, this bill needs to move forward. And I want to take a moment. You were just given a packet of some additional letters of support that have come in from individual Alaskans around the state, several from Palmer, which might be of interest to one of the members here, and some from organizations including the Network on Domestic Violence and Sexual Assault and other women's organizations that are very familiar with the impact of sexual assault and the trauma that the victims experience. I also want to just take a moment to talk a little bit about the fiscal note, and I think the department will be able to talk a little bit more about this. But just to give the detail again, what we envision with this bill is creating a standard protocol for how these rape kits are processed, as well as a database for keeping track of them. So the fiscal note had a link to a description of the sexual assault kit tracking and inventory management. And so it describes how this is used. Part of the fiscal note shows the cost for that, about $100,000 for that particular database and how it tracks that information. And they state that it would require additional staffing to help meet these requirements. I think even in lean budget times, these are dollars very well spent. And I hope that will be something that you all consider in looking at this bill. And I think we also have to consider, when we think about the financial impacts, what happens when someone is sexually assaulted. We know that a lot of sexual assaults are committed by an individual who a victim knows. But in the case of Mr. Lee, who I mentioned in the beginning, these were those extraordinarily traumatic events of a stranger rape where women were attacked and brutalized. And it's enough to bring me to tears to think about how difficult it is for an individual to overcome that circumstance. And people's lives often fall apart, and people commit suicide. And they end their life from that kind of trauma. So $260,000 is difficult in our budget time, but if we can save any one victim, I think it's dollars well spent. Thank you.
Representative Birch.
Well, I for one want to commend the sponsor of this effort. I think it's an excellent approach. I guess the question that jumps out to me is why is there? I mean why? I mean, it seems unconscionable that you would have these things, you know, kind of laying around in the back room and you're not taking care of them through the chair. What's the excuse for not? And how old are some of the kits? I mean, how long have they been languishing, if you will, in the evidence lockers?
And before you answer, Representative, I should note that we also have available for questions Oren Din from the State Crime Lab, as well as Captain Dan Loden from the State Troopers as well.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Through the chair, excellent questions, and I think the individuals that the chair just mentioned would be great to add some information, because we do have Department of Public Safety strong support for this, and they can talk a little bit about this. But currently, the kits are sent out to any number of law enforcement organizations, but they're not tracked from the moment they're sent out to that agency. So the potential exists for, you know, in that, if you would think of it as a chain of command, but something to be lost along the way. Of course, that's not the intent, but without a tracking system, you can't say with certainty that that's not happening. Another reason that they might not be tested is, in many sexual assault cases, it's a known perpetrator. So in that particular case, it's not relevant to that case. But that individual may have been involved in other crimes. And by not using that DNA evidence, that's why that powerful database is so important. By not collecting that evidence and testing that evidence, we eliminate the possibility of linking that individual to another crime. And I think this recent story, what was so startling for me was the day this bill came out in the pre-files was the same day that article was in the Anchorage and the Alaska Dispatch News. And just underscored, you know, how problematic this could be. Some of the untested kits go back years. And I mentioned that the individual might request not to have it tested. I've been working on these issues for quite a while now, and like I say, I mean, it can really bring you to tears, this kind of suffering people experience after a traumatic event like that. And some victims just choose, they want to try and move on. They just really want to try and move on with their life. And so in their circumstance, you know, they know that that would be a multi-year court case. They'd have to go in for possible follow-up testing. They'd have to testify in court. That may just seem like an insurmountable, you know, set of events that would just be too difficult to go through. So there's a variety of those reasons. And like I say, I think some of the other individuals can speak to that with a little more detail. But what we can segregate from that is we can protect that victim and give them, you know, the space and path forward while also using this DNA evidence for its intended purpose.
And Representative Butch, would you like the Department of Public Safety to give a whack at that question?
Yeah, that would be helpful. And again, through the chair, I believe it would have been a constituent, Bonnie Craig, I believe it was, and that case was a cold case, and it languished for years, and was ultimately solved on a DNA hit for somebody, you know, half a continent away. And so I am absolutely supportive of this effort. An initiative, and I would appreciate a little more background. And you know, in other words, hopefully this isn't something that is accruing, that we're not building up a backlog, that we're getting to a position where we're able to stay ahead of it. But I would, some comments maybe from some of the public safety would be helpful.
And I see Department of Public Safety representatives in the room as well. I guess I would defer to you, Ms. Howell, and as it were, who from DPS would be best suited to take this question, whether it's Mr. Dim or Captain Loden online or anyone in the room.
And I would take a stab at that, Mr. Chairman, while maybe DPS folks confer.
Sure.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And through the chair, I will add that the 3,600 members are current backlog, and it's not uncommon. That's why I think this national effort emerged. In 2015, when I started working on it, it was after receiving some information from a national organization called End the Backlog. And, you know, of course, you get this information, you think, well, what's going on in my own state? And at the time, we didn't have a good idea of what our backlog was. Simultaneous to that, the Federal Department of Justice recognized this as a critical public safety need and developed a grant program to help states get through their backlog. And the first step was completing an audit, because they wouldn't give you the funding until you could say what your backlog was and what your need was to get through that. So We started working on the bill. Then Governor Walker's office carried that effort forward. They worked with the law enforcement agencies to complete the audit. Not everyone, I'm told, participated, and that might be something to get a little more info on, but they sufficiently met the requirements of the grant application, were able to submit that, and receive the $1.1 million grant that should help us get through the existing backlog. That's the 3,600. What we want to prevent is from happening again, and by setting some time parameters, then we know that'll happen in a timely fashion.
And Captain Loden or Mr. Dim, does one of you feel well suited to answer Representative Birch's question, which I think fundamentally boils down to why? Why is there a backlog?
Through the chair, this is Captain Loden in Anchorage. I'm on the director staff with the state troopers. I think that Representative Tarr touched on many of the different reasons that kits have gone untested. The victim may choose not to do so. The perpetrator is known to the police, charged, might go into court and plead out before the kits are tested. There's a lot of variety. I don't think any of these cases ever involve us. We're just not interested. I think one of the things we're starting to see in the national thought process is that when these kits were taken, they are often thought of as a individual case. And the case that Representative Tarr talked about is we're realizing that there are serial perpetrators out there, and that by testing kits that we might not have done so in the past, we're missing some of these folks. So the department does support this, and we believe that by testing more kits, we will catch more people.
Follow-up, Representative Birch?
Yeah, I guess the follow-up is opposition to this. I'm trying to understand, are there people where the perpetrator is known, and they just figure it's redundant if somebody either pleads out or you get a conviction? Is the kit then resigned to the trash bin? Or is there a point in time where you say, I guess we don't need this anymore, and we avoid the cost of doing the data work on that kit? Through the chair.
Representative, through the chair, that Mr. Dim might be able to explain how long we keep them. I believe there are rules in place that we just don't throw them around. I suspect that the cost of doing the exam, again, when it was looked at as an individual case, might very well have played into those decisions. In other words, this individual case occurred, the person was convicted before the test could even be completed. Okay, maybe we don't need to expend the money. Again, I think the thought processes are starting to change about how these kits can help us in other cases.
Okay, just by way of follow-up, I think you have many, unfortunately, you have many domestic violence situations where there's, ostensibly a reconciliation, everybody's, back together again, but then it's repeated. And I guess I'm just trying to find out what kind of control you have when you receive the kit, as far as, I guess it's kind of probably delving into the legal realm, but by and large, I mean, just seems like a good move, and I'm stunned that there's such a backlog, I guess. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Yeah. Representative Knopp, you had a question?
I did.
Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So for the sponsor of the bill, Representative Tarr, so on page 2, the first line, 18 months after collection, I'm kind of wondering why 18 months, why not 30 days, 60 days, 90 days? Why do we want to wait 18 months? First question, and follow-up question would be, and that's just to send it out. So when you send it out, I don't know if it's going out of state or where it's going, but is there a time frame for them to complete the test and get the results back?
Thank you, Representative Knapp, through the chair. On the first question, I wanted a time frame that was reasonable, and so we were trying to figure out, you know, what is the expense associated with this and how do we do it in a reasonable time frame. And as it's been described to me by the prosecutors, in some of the cases where they're trying to gather enough evidence to bring something to trial, there's often, you know, some number of months that that takes. And so we were trying to sort of make sure that, you know, our time frame fit within what was reasonable for that time frame. If there's an opportunity to make it happen more quickly, I'm right there. I support you 100% in that effort. What I can tell you is when we received the fiscal note, I asked, you know, if we gave a little more time on the other end, you know, knowing the concerns we have right now with our serious budget problem. And, you know, if we extended to 24 months, it wasn't going to cost any less. And on the fiscal note, one of the items is a position to help with this. So I expect that following this law, that the processing would be done in-house and that additional staff person would have, you know, give the capacity necessary to complete those tests. My understanding is right now we do some in-state, and Mr. Dim would be much better suited to answer this, but for example, with the federal grant that we received, we will be sending those out of state for processing.
Follow up. Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, now I'm getting to my math question right now. And I believe you said there was a gentleman who knew what the process currently was as far as when we get them, how long we keep them, what we do with them. I'm looking forward to hearing that because if we got a 3,600 number backlog right now, so you're talking 9.5 years at one a day. If you have a rape kit every single day for 9.5 years, that's what we have. Mm-hmm. And so it's kind of hard for me to fathom that we're doing a rape kit every single day at 3,600 backlog. So I guess I'm looking for that answer. Are we doing one every single day? Do we have a 10-year backlog? And so.
Well, through the chair, Representative Knapp, it's a great question, and that's why these federal grant funds are going to be critical to this effort. Those funds should be directed to meeting that backlog, which will mean, you know, many more will be processed much more quickly than that to get in line with that. And what we did, if you'll notice, with the effective date of the bill, what we wanted to do was, this takes effect January 1st, 2018, was give them time to work through this backlog before the effective date. And, you know, our hope is that that would be a seamless transition from completing this work right now and then meeting the requirements of a new law.
Okay, but I didn't get my question answered.
Mm-hmm.
So my question is it a 10-year backlog at one a day or a 20-year backlog at one every other day? I want to know how, your 3,600 number, I'd like to know how far back that backlog is. I guess, and you may not have that, but that's the number I'm looking for.
And if I may, Representative Knapp, yeah. is the question, what's the pace by which rape kits can be processed?
It's not really that, but we use this as somewhat telling us what the backlog is, how far we are, because we don't have a process or time frame for getting them out. So I want to make sure that the information we get is really factual and accurate is what I'm looking for. And actually, I'm kind of looking for information. Are we really doing one a day? I mean, that's what I want to know. Is it that bad? And so that's the second component of that question, because I am really ignorant on this issue, and I don't know the answer to that. So that's really what I was looking for, frequency.
And I wonder if the Department of Public Safety, Captain Loudon, or Mr. Dim, if it would be possible to get information on the current pace by which rape kits can be processed, and if this legislation were passed with a new forensic analysis 3 position, what the pace would be, and also how grant funds might figure into that. So I'm seeing nodding from the back of the room from the Department of Public Safety, so we'll look forward to that information. And good question, Representative Knapp. Representative Johnson, do you still have a question?
No, I'm good, thank you.
Representative Wall?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Tarr, and other people on the phone and in the room. I'm just reading one of the letters from the Tennessee Coalition, where they had 12,000 untested kits, and they got through their backlog, and now they have a 60-day law where they have within 60 days to submit for testing or could be put in a hold if the person didn't want to press charges and held for 3 years if they did want to press charges. So, I mean, that's interesting numbers, and I don't know the answer to Representative Knopf's question, but I'm guessing if they have to, they can push through quite a few. Are currently all the rape kits tested in-state in Alaska? You know, evidence that's gathered in Alaska, is it tested in-state or out-of-state?
Through the chair, Representative Wohl, a combination of both. And as it's been described to me, it has to do with the complexities of the evidence collected and what specific analysis we have capabilities for in our lab versus something that's more sophisticated outside. And to Representative Knopf's question, you know, if you've got the money to pay for it, there are scientists who can process this evidence. So, you know, once you have the capacity, they can do it a lot more quickly. And I would, and I hope Mr. Dim can speak to that or the department, but my understanding is this, it's expected that the backlog would be tested much more quickly than, you know, the timeline you're suggesting, which would be really, really problematic.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess along those lines, and maybe you partially answered it, that some kits have different types of evidence than others. Do you or someone from the crime lab, do they have a sort of dollar value, what it costs to process a kit? Yeah, I was just wondering if there's an approximate value to that.
Through the chair, Representative Wohl, on page 2 of the fiscal note, it talks about the backlog, and it talks about that costing about $1,500 per kit. And that these costs, you know, the backlog costs are not included in the fiscal note because that's what the federal grant would cover. But just as a point of reference, so about $1,500, that would be the standard cost. And I, as I understand it, could be more costly. There was an audit of the crime lab, and I don't want to sort of divert this conversation into that. Mr. Dim may talk about that a little bit more, but you know, there's some particulars and some questions about proper training and chain of command, and I think you know, this bill could help improve the overall process of how things are done and make it you know, a much more effective process.
Representative Birch.
Is it fair to say, for those of us that have, you know, done the 23andMe exercise, it's a, you know, $100 bill, that the additional cost is probably due to the legal issues of trying to establish with a chain of custody, where you're trying to make sure you've got you know, that everybody, when you have evidence, that it follows a specific path and is fully accountable all the way through. So I'm assuming that that might be some of the a piece of the cost component through the chair.
Through the chair, yes, thank you. And in that first paragraph on page 2 of the, excuse me, not the first paragraph, third paragraph on page 2 of the fiscal note, it talks about the tracking system and that, and so that's the $96,000 right there, and so that would accomplish that.
Thank you.
Representative Wohl. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative, obviously a lot of this information is all written here, but I just want to point out that 3,000 backlog kits at $1,500 is quite a lot of money, $4.5 million I'm calculating, and obviously your fiscal note doesn't address that issue at all. That's a whole separate issue with a whole separate financing need.
Thank you. Through the chair, yes.
Thank you. And I wonder if at this time we can open public testimony. I see two people in the room who signed up to testify publicly, both of whom associated with organizations that have also submitted written testimony. So in light of that fact, what I'm going to suggest is we limit public testimony to 3 minutes per person in order to have a little bit of buffer before we transition to the finance subcommittee. So at this time, I'm going to open public testimony. And I see we have an eager volunteer. Would you be willing to identify yourself on the record and state your affiliation and present your testimony?
Yes, Crystal Godby. And I'm with the Community United for Safety and Protection. We're a group of current, former sex workers, sex trafficking victims, and allies working towards safety to protecting everyone in Alaska's sex industry. We would like to expand our full support for this important bill. Perpetrators must know that they are going to suffer consequences for their heinous crimes because rape kits are no longer going to be hidden away as the lowest priorities. Alaska will never stop being the rape capital of the United States as long as we don't even have rape kids prioritize. To process them and then match results with state national database to hold accountability for those responsible in a timely manner. In 2014, Detroit identified 188 serial rapists by processing just 1,600 rape kits out of their much larger backlog. In December of 2016, Community United for Safety and Protection, Hayes Research Fund, and Anchorage conducted a survey of 904 Alaskan voter priorities. Processing Alaska's backlog of rape kits was a close second priority to investigating cases of murdered and missing sex workers, with 36 listing it as their first priority and 37 listing it as their second priority. Clearly, Alaska takes this issue seriously and are in agreement with passing House Bill 31. Please vote on House Bill 31. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Ms. Cogby. Are there any questions from the committee? Thank you, and thank you for your written testimony as well. Next, Ms. Dr. Carmen Lowry with Alaska Network on Domestic Violence and Sexual Assault.
Good afternoon. For the record, my name is Carmen Lowry, and I am the Executive Director of the Alaska Network on Domestic Violence and Sexual Assault. I want to start out by just saying that we are very grateful for being able to be here and provide testimony and appreciate the committee's full attention to this. The Alaska Network on Domestic Violence, we are representing 18 member programs from across the state. Those are four member programs, most of whom, with the exception of STAR in Anchorage, provide shelter and emergency services to victims and survivors of domestic violence and sexual assault. We also have six affiliate members who are also part of our large network. So on behalf of all of them, thank you very much for this opportunity. I'd like to start out by saying that we, the Alaska Network on Domestic Violence, we fully support House Bill 31. And I just want to talk a little bit about the areas of why we support that, and then talk a little bit about some of the issues around victims and with victims giving their consent to be able to move forward or to report. But I want to talk about, first of all, that this bill really raises the accountability. And the accountability goes up for victims, for law enforcement, particularly people who are members of SART, and also to taxpayers. And this is coming out of, in October, I was out in Bethel. And I was out in Bethel one time before working. And we were talking about the SART, the Sexual Assault Response Team. And the group will go in to do examinations and to collect data and to collect evidence for prosecution. And the thing is that we have to have a system whereby we know what is going on. So we need to know how many kits are going out. We need to know where they are. We need to know how many are coming back in. Not to place blame anywhere, but to understand where the problem is. And I want to thank the members of the committee who did raise up those issues to say, why is this happening? The way that we will get to know why this is happening is to really investigate what is going on. So part of that is to understand how these kits are being moved or not moved. The second area that is, again, in this fiscal climate is around the efficiency. And the efficiency in particular is about looking at what's going on in these rural communities. Because we know that there's a lack of law enforcement sometimes in some of the smaller communities where sexual assaults occur. We have to better understand how to become more efficient. Where do we need to put our resources? And this bill, with its emphasis on understanding the backlog, of understanding the process, would enable us to understand that. And of course, finally, is around effectiveness, and we know that it would lead to better prosecution. Perhaps people may know, the perpetrator may be known to law enforcement or may be known to the victim, but as we've seen, it's very important to be able to have that information and evidence to enter into a DNA registration. And then the final point that we wanted to talk about are some of the issues that Representative Tarr brought up and that we also heard brought up through the Tennessee Coalition, so thank you for bringing that to our forefront. We have to differentiate this need for the state to be able to track where rape exam kits are and to look at what the bottleneck may be with victims' rights to decide if they want to prosecute or not. And certainly the Tennessee Coalition has got some guidance on what they've done in their state on how to deal with that. We can look at a white paper that was recently submitted through the Office of Violence Against Women that was looking at this. So there's a lot of conversations going on. But we really want to say that we believe this would be a great addition, that it would allow for us to really respect the process of gathering evidence. The process of gathering evidence, of populating what is required for these kits, is very intensive, it's very intimate, it's very invasive, and we want to make sure that victims are respected. That when that happens, the message is, if we do this kind of evidence gathering through a rape examination kit, something will come from it. And that's the key message we would like to give. So I want to thank you all very much for your time and your commitment, and we are here to help answer any questions that we can.
Thank you, Ms. Lowry. And I believe there is a question from Representative Birch.
First of all, Ms. Lowry, through the chair, thank you so much for your good work, your commitment, and for your testimony. It's very constructive, very helpful. One a question that has come up is in smaller communities, and as far as it relates to the kit that may be gathered under, obviously under some duress with the victim is, I wouldn't say victimized twice, but they're victimized, and then they've got to go through a pretty challenging exam. You have to put evidence into play. But I guess my curiosity centers on ownership of that kit after there's an assault charge. And if you're in a smaller community where witnesses recant their testimony, or a victim is basically prevailed on to have a change of heart, and does that kit stay in in play, or in the ownership of a prosecuting entity, or the lab, or how does that work? And I'm concerned because I think there is some indication that in smaller communities, particularly, and maybe others, that the victim is convinced to have a change course, and then you've got the kit there, and but I don't know how the custody works. If you could explain that, that'd be helpful. Thank you.
Through the chair, Representative Birch, that is an excellent question. I don't know the answer to that. I am sure that we can find out that information. I think that's important information to have. So I don't know, but we will certainly get back to the committee with that kind of information.
Yeah, it'd be helpful. But again, thank you very much. I had a great tour of the Awake facility, and I've long supported them in Anchorage. And again, appreciate your testimony and efforts. Thank you.
Seeing no other questions, thank you, Ms. Lowry. And I see there's a final member of the public to testify. I realize we're running up relatively close to the 4:30 marker, but I think with this we can close public testimony and revisit this legislation on Thursday and perhaps take action. Ms. Keeley Olson with Stand Together Against Rape, STAR, Executive Director in Anchorage, please identify yourself and state your affiliation for the record and present your testimony.
Hello, my name is Keeley Olson, and I'm the Executive Director of Standing Together Against Rape in Anchorage, otherwise known as STAR. Thank you to the Chair, thank you to the committee. I wanted to state that I applaud Representative Tull's proposed bill. This is, as she previously stated, the best standard practice recognized nationwide after getting a handle on an audit and what the current backlog is. It is critical to determine what the consistent process will be for all law enforcement agencies across the state moving forward. And without that, I think we come back to the same questions that have been put forth by the members of the committee and the representatives, saying, how did we arrive at this place? And frankly, none of us can answer those questions. Without something like this bill being put in place, we will not be able to answer those questions in another 5 years, in another 10 years. I think that all of the questions and the comments from our members of the committee and the chair were very cogent, and while some have stated that they're not very well informed, I think that everyone is asking very excellent questions, and I think that this bill is the answer to get those answers. I would want to clarify one thing as far as there are many jurisdictions throughout the state that have alternative reporting, they're called different things in different parts of the state or different segments of the nation, and so one of the terms is non-investigative reports, and in English we call them anonymous victim reports, where someone has an opportunity who has been a victim of a sexual assault to come forward and undergo a forensic examination and thereby collect that evidence and salvage that evidence and save it for processing and save it in case they choose and elect to move forward with a law enforcement investigation. So those are collected solely with a forensic police examiner and an advocate present without law enforcement being informed. And I want to make sure that we are aware of that and that we are not getting into a situation where any kits that were not reported to law enforcement are being included in this. A victim of a sexual assault may come forward any time after undergoing an anonymous victim report and request to have that case opened up to full investigation, and then it will move forward and processing can occur. But I want to make sure that we are not going to be in a position where we risk coercing victims' participation in a criminal legal process against their will and further undermining their autonomy and their self-determination. Again, it comes down to the respect of the persons who have undergone the violation, and that we are treating them with the utmost respect and utmost care. Other than that, I agree with absolutely everything that was stated by both Representative Tarr, and again, we'd like to thank her for bringing this forward, this proposed bill, and I would also echo the sentiments of Carmen Lauer with the network. So thank you very much.
Representative Birch, a very quick question.
A brief question. Is it your through the chair, is it your testimony then that there are some kits or rape kits and where the testing and the research is done and the sampling, if you will, that the victim may choose not to submit to law enforcement, that they would be kind of held in some sort of a holding pattern?
Through the chair, Representative Birch, yes, that is the case. And it is to provide options to open up reporting to perhaps people who would be hesitant to come forward, who may, for whatever reason, be intimidated by maybe the full investigative process. But they do understand that it is necessary to collect evidence within a timely manner. And then they reserve the right to open those cases to investigation, and we've had some very successful prosecutions as a result of that. And that is a compliance that is required under the Violence Against Women Act, and Anchorage definitely has it in place. I believe the troopers have it in place. I'm not sure if it's available everywhere in Alaska, but it is definitely available in a lot of jurisdictions. And they should not be misconstrued with cases that have been reported to law enforcement.
Thank you. I'll look forward to learning more about that aspect between now and our next hearing. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
And
thank
and,
you.
With that, I think I'm going to leave public testimony open so we can perhaps continue that dialogue on Thursday and for now move on from this bill and adjourn the committee at 4:32 out of respect for our finance colleagues. We'll meet again 3 p.m. this Thursday, that being February 2nd.